This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's been summer in the Northern Hemisphere when viewers and journalists drift into platitudes and cat videos. Meanwhile, the planet is going through extreme changes not seen during the time of humans. We're going to spend this program going through the science that should have been foot-high headlines around the world, plus some small signals of big things to come. Our guest is climate scientist and returning Radio EcoShock guest Paul Beckwith. Paul teaches climate and earth science at Canada's University of Ottawa. That's the country's capital. He's got two master's degrees, and he's working on his PhD in climate science. Beckwith's YouTube videos, I think, have now, I can say, they've been seen by millions, where he lays out the case we are already in a global climate emergency. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to speak to you on your show.
Well, let's start at the bottom, so to speak. According to the UK research group Project Midas, a crack in the Larsen C ice sheet in Antarctica grew 14 miles longer just since last March. A chunk of ice about the size of the American state of Delaware is expected to break off sometime in the next few years. Paul, what does that mean and what does that tell us?
Well, we've had Larsen A break up. It was the first one to go. And it kind of was a very abrupt breakup. You know, there were signs that it was weakening. The color was changing from on satellite images. Same with Larsen B. And then suddenly when it went, over the space of about a week or so, it just basically completely disintegrated. So this is part of the warming trend that we're seeing. In the case of Antarctica, most of the melting that is going on the bottom surface of the ice sheets that are connected to the coast. Of course, the glaciers on land are moving more quickly. They're flowing downhill on the continent, but the ocean water underneath is warming. So especially on the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is grounded well below sea level, when the ocean is warming, then we're getting melt there. And also there's a lot of retrograde beds around Antarctica. So as you get melting and go inland, the water gets deeper. So that destabilizes the particular ice sheet, and it can go very quickly. So we know that Antarctica is losing ice mass, as is Greenland, and this is measured very accurately from GRACE, the gravity anomaly satellites.
But I think some bloggers misunderstood it, because the original article said, well, if that ice breaks off, it's holding back ice behind it, that if all of that melts would add about 4 inches to the global sea levels. But in fact, this particular ice sheet, if it breaks off, is already floating on the sea, so it won't itself rise the sea levels, but it will weaken the barrier that's holding back stuff that will. Is that right?
Yes, like ice sheets are attached to the on-land glacier. So parts of the ice sheet right near the shore, it might not necessarily be floating, but they're attached to the vast majority of the ice sheet is floating. So it's like the sea ice in the Arctic. When it melts, it doesn't raise the sea level, but what it does is, in the case of the Antarctic ice sheets, is it releases the cork on the bottle, if you like, and it allows the on-land glacier ice to move much more quickly and have much more calving into the ocean, which then does raise the sea levels rapidly.
There's some great resources out there now, Paul, where we can all kind of participate in the science, or at least see what's happening on our world. One example is the website earth.nullschool.net. That's earth.nullschool.net. They give real-time planetary reporting. For example, at the start of September, just as the long Antarctic winter was ending, a big blast of heat seemingly made it all the way from the equator, made it from somewhere, to West Antarctica, setting new records and taking some areas above the melt point months ahead of normal. Talk to us about that, Paul.
Yes, so the Earth Null School, it's a very good website where you can just Google it, Google Earth Null School, and find the website. And then you see a globe, and you see the word Earth on the bottom left corner. Just click on that, and it brings up a menu. And play around with that menu, because you can look at just about any parameter that you want connected with the meteorology. So what's going on in the atmosphere, the temperatures, the pressures. So you can see low pressure areas, which are cyclones and, you know, hurricanes, storms, et cetera. You can see how they're tracking. The data is updated about every 3 hours. So you can actually cycle through and see the movement of the winds and the ocean currents and temperatures and everything you want. And you can move the Earth around. You can expand it with the slider, mouse slider, and you can basically study, you know, yourself, what's going on. If you hear about a storm somewhere or about an event, something happening somewhere, really hot temperatures, you could just go on there and you can see for yourself, you know, how it's distributed on the planet. It's a fascinating tool, which I encourage everybody to become familiar with. So we're seeing a lot of distortion in the jet streams, and the jet streams guide storms. They guide weather around the planet. They actually act as walls between very cold, dry air, say, you know, at the pole, and warmer, humid air from further south. You know, specifically in the northern hemisphere, as the Arctic gets incredibly warm, lowering the temperature gradient to the equator, the jet streams slow down and become very, very wavy. And the far northern excursions, the crests of the waves, actually have extended right up to the North Pole. In December of last year and also in September of last year, they went right up to the North Pole. And they're extending very, very far south. And in fact, I had a video a few months ago talking about them crossing the equator. You know, it's a very controversial video. So in the southern hemisphere, we're also seeing a strong distortion of the jet stream. And they can actually go right down and bring very warm air to very far southerly regions, even to the West Antarctic Peninsula, or up in the northern hemisphere, up across Greenland, and cause very unusually very, very warm conditions. And then if the jet streams move, then that condition could change very quickly back to what it was before.
Well, Paul, I know you're reaching far too many people with your YouTube videos and your Twitter feeds and your Facebook posts. When the Washington Post thinks you're worth a good old-fashioned attack piece, I thought it was terrible. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, so one of the things that I've wondered about in terms of the jet streams is if you carry the warming, say, in the Arctic to the extreme where it's as warm for long periods of time as much lower latitude, then there's no significant temperature gradient. And the temperature gradient with latitude is what causes the jet streams to form in the first place. So if there's no temperature gradient, then is there a jet stream? I mean, do the jet streams just completely, do they stop? Do they fracture and break up so they're not recognizable? You know, what happens in the extreme? So we do know that they cross the equator when there's monsoons, but that behavior is somewhat different. They cross at almost a grazing angle. So they're almost parallel to the equator. There was a report by Robert Scribler on the jet streams crossing the equator. So I had a look at it and then looked at all the data myself and then did a video. Now, the video was jet streams crossing the equator, you know, unprecedented question mark. Although initially, for some reason, the question mark didn't appear. And so the Post went and jumped on this and said, oh, jet streams cross the equator. So I put it out one night and then I don't know, there are about 5,000-6,000 views by the next day or something, midday. And then it started getting a lot more views, you know, an awful lot more views. So, and I think, you know, it went up quite high. So this got the attention of mainstream media. So they had a look at it and they focused completely on the word unprecedented. You know, I was also saying this is indicative of our climate emergency. I've been talking about us being under a global climate emergency for quite a while now. But they jumped, the Washington Post jumped on that phrase and said, Beckwith is saying, you know, we are in a climate emergency because the jet streams are crossing the equator and it's never happened before, but yet it has happened before. So, you know, he's full of himself sort of thing. So, you know, I did a couple of video rebuttals to it. So they misrepresented completely what I was saying. So, you know, I had an email exchange with the writer of the article and eventually they published my response, which was also, you know, commented on by them. And I had an Inhabit interview very recently where it was a very detailed interview where I cleared up exactly what I was saying on it. So I think they were just looking for something to try to nail me on.
Yeah, I knew it was a hatchet job as soon as I saw them call on Dr. Roy Spencer as a source. I mean, from Alabama, Spencer's been dragging down climate science, helping climate deniers make their case. He only recently had to admit the Earth really is warming and it's not caused by the sun. So I don't even want to go into all that because, Paul, I'm here as a witness. You've been calling for a climate emergency action for years. You've had a powerful YouTube video on that just last spring, and I totally agree. My Radio EcoShock show for December 30th, 2005, one of my early ones, was called Time to Panic. And it is time to panic, way past that. We've only gone downhill since then. So if you had to list, say, three top signs we are in a climate emergency, what would they be?
Well, number one has to be the temperature, what the temperature has been doing on the surface of the earth, on the land and on the oceans this particular year, in fact. I mean, if you look at graphs of temperature over the years, you know, you get this rise and you can see the upward trend. This year has blown away all of these records. I mean, the line is way above and beyond anything else, any other year. And in fact, I guess it was February of 2016 where the global average temperature actually had exceeded that 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, you know, for almost the entire month. And it actually exceeded the 2-degree limit for a few days. So we're actually pushing against the numbers that are deemed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the global negotiators to all countries saying we've got to keep the temperature below 2 degrees. And then in Paris, they said we really have to aim to keep it below 1.5 degrees. And that's what all the policymakers and negotiators in these climate conferences are working on. You know, we still don't have a global carbon price. I mean, we need a global carbon price. I mean, that's key. So temperatures is the one thing. I guess another thing is the extremely rapid melting of the ice caps. Greenland's kicking off about over 250 gigatons of mass loss. So that's the ice melting and draining off into the oceans. 250 gigatons per year. That's slightly higher than what Antarctica is giving off. And if you look back over the last 20 odd years, that's about three doubling periods. So the rate of melt from Greenland and Antarctica is doubling roughly every 7 years or so. That's a doubling in 7 years, and then another doubling in 7 years, and another doubling, and that's an 8 times increase in about 20 years, which is incredibly fast. And as a result, the sea level rise is accelerating. This is already having an impact on coastlines. There's flooding events in Florida, for example. They call them sunny day flooding events. And it's just if you get, a particularly high tide, then on top of the sea level rise from climate change, then, you know, it's flooding shorelines and roads and things and even in Miami. And you can't build a wall. You know, you can't build a Trump-type wall to protect the place because the water would just seep right underneath. It's limestone based. So this is a number two, I guess. And number three is just the statistics of the extreme weather events. I mean, we're seeing extreme weather events skyrocketing around the world in terms of frequency, severity, and intensity. You know, that's the third thing. I mean, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, and we've changed the chemistry of the oceans, and the planet is warming, so we're getting more water. We've changed the hydrological cycle. We've completely changed it. You know, and these will all eventually come and bite us soon. We'll have a global food shortage 1 year. You know, prices will skyrocket. But, you know, people talk about sort of one event. I mean, people are always, you know, humans are saying, okay, well, one event, like what's going to happen? Like if it's a meteor impact, okay, that's pretty clear. You can talk about one event. But the abrupt climate change is not one event. It's more like death by a thousand cuts, let's say.
Radio EcoShock.
One of the climate stories ripped out of the back pages of the news, NASA says the record low Arctic sea ice levels in the last few years are the new normal. We are not going back. But, Paul, you think it's important to at least try to restore the Arctic sea ice. Why?
Yes. Well, I don't think we can call anything the new normal, really. Like when you go through an abrupt change, you go from one state of stability relative stability to another state of relative stability. And then in between those states, you have very, very rapid changes. You know, we're in the middle state where we have very, very rapid changes. So there is no new normal for anything, really. But in terms of the sea ice, the sea ice is trending down to zero extremely rapidly. And in fact, there was a remote possibility that in a few weeks, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks at the end of the melt season, the minimum sea ice is usually about mid-September. So if it's between September 15th and 20th or something, that would be normal. Of course, it could be extended if the water is so warm and depending on the conditions. But the problem with the sea ice going is that it keeps the Arctic cool. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to melt ice. And if you take that tremendous amount of energy to melt, say, well, to put it in numbers, the amount of energy required to melt 1 kilogram of ice is equivalent to the amount of energy to raise water temperature from 1 kilogram of water from 0 degrees Celsius to 80 degrees. In other words, if you take a kilogram of ice and float it in a kilogram of water at 80 degrees Celsius, what temperature do you end up with? You end up with 2 kilograms of water, and it's not halfway between 80 and zero. It's 0 degrees Celsius. The energy that is in that 80 degree C water is all required to melt that 1 kilogram of ice and bring it to 0 degrees Celsius. And I've actually put the question on the Twitter survey, and I think, you know, a lot of people that follow me know the answer. So, you know, about 20% of the people, I think, got it correct. And these are people that follow me. You know, I've talked about this sort of thing before. So the sea ice is very important for keeping the Arctic region cool, because it absorbs the solar energy, and that goes into melting, but then it stays cool because the ice is still there. But the ice also is very reflective, and it reflects a lot of the incident radiation. So the albedo, or reflectivity, of the Arctic region is dropping extremely fast, and the sea ice is a big part of that. But it's not the biggest part, surprisingly. The biggest part is the snow cover covering the land in the spring months. So in April, May, June, in the Arctic, the snow cover on the land around the region is very important, because if there is snow cover, it's highly reflective, and if there isn't snow cover, then we have the dark permafrost underneath, which then absorbs solar radiation. And the snow cover in the spring months has been dropping roughly at a rate of about 24% per decade in terms of area, and the sea ice extent has been dropping at about 12 or 13% per decade. So the actual decline of snow cover in the spring is larger. So the effects are comparable overall in terms of making the Arctic darker. Now, we also have Greenland, the mass of ice sitting on Greenland. You know, ice, highly reflective. But the problem is we've got the black carbon on the ice, and that's also on the sea ice. You know, it's on any surface in the Arctic, and that's coming from northern fires in Siberia in the peat, and also boreal forest fires in northern Canada. And we've also got these feedbacks, like as the ice melts on Greenland, the elevation drops. We've got 3 kilometers thick ice, and as it's melting and that thickness is decreasing, the altitude is dropping, which will lead to more, you know, a strong feedback, because it gets warmer as you go to lower altitude. The entire Arctic is darkening, and this is a problem because it's absorbing more and more solar radiation. And it leads to very strong temperature amplification, which then leads to, it has a huge effect on the jet streams. The jet streams slow down and become wavier and become fractured, and we get all these extreme weather events as a result. We get things like Louisiana flooding or Colorado flooding a few years ago. So we get these extremes of weather because the jet streams are completely distorted and messed up. So if we were to restore ice in the Arctic, then we could reduce the darkening, make it lighter, restore some strength in the jet streams, and get back to some sort of normalcy if we were able to do that. So I call that leg two of this sort of three-legged bar stool. Leg one is to slash fossil fuel emissions. Leg two is to cool the Arctic, to stabilize the ice. And leg three is to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
All right. Moving to a completely different part of the world, the Independent newspaper in Britain ran this headline: climate change could make parts of the Middle East and North Africa uninhabitable. Your thoughts, Paul?
Yes. So a certain temperature limit, when it gets too hot, you start getting problems with molecules making up plants, and plants in particular, they're not able to function as they would normally do. So photosynthesis can stop when you get a denature rising of the protein bonds, for example, in molecules. So So everything has a temperature range, you know, under which it exists. And the geographic distribution of plants and animals on the Earth, sort of the biogeography of the flora and fauna on the Earth, depends on both the temperature range at a particular latitude and the water content, so the precipitation. So if those things change, then that particular area that is optimal for a particular species can change. So with our warming, things are migrating to poleward. So both animals and plants are migrating poleward. Now, at the equator, because of the warming and because of the additional water vapor in the atmosphere, for every degree rise in temperature, there's about 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere. So this is making parts of the equatorial region so hot and so humid that they actually surpass the biological limits of humans. So I'm talking about a 35 degree Celsius temperature with 100% humidity. So that condition is being reached in, say, the Middle East, especially near areas like the Persian Gulf. So when the water temperature is 35 degrees Celsius, or roughly that temperature, then it's very, very humid because there's lots of evaporation on the coastlines. And that will bring you up to almost 100% humidity. And as you go inland, it's certainly much warmer than 35. So people cannot exist or live outside in those conditions because the human body is not physically capable of sweating. So the core body temperature just rises throughout the day and you reach heat exhaustion and heat stroke over the course of the day in those conditions. You have to be inside in air conditioning in order to keep the core body temperature lower. So we've actually surpassed that limit in some regions in the last few years in that area. And also, we've surpassed temperatures in India and Pakistan of, 54 degrees Celsius, which is just, incredible. I mean, the humidity would not be 100, but if you reach 54, you can figure out the humidity at which, where the wet bulb temperature is too high that you can no longer sweat. So, areas of the Earth near the equator will very soon be, uninhabitable. I mean, that's with our present overall warming that we have now. I mean, when all the models project that we'll, of course, continue to rise and be much, much hotter. The only question is, how long will that take?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm pretty sure that is partly the reason that so many Somalian and North African refugees are flooding into Italy right now. I mean, you can say, sure, there's a war there, there's economic problems, but it's also just so hot and so uncomfortable, they must be dreaming about a place cool enough to live. Well, I'd like to move on, Paul, to a story I think is huge. I'm reaching out to the authors of this new paper to get a full interview, but in the meantime, they're talking about zombie emissions. It's a new class of greenhouse gas commitments, this time coming from tropical forests that are already cut down. I'll take a second to describe it. A study in the journal Current Biology found that even when there's a 30% reduction in deforestation in the Amazon, carbon emissions only went down 10%. Why? Well, that's because there's a huge pool of carbon making its way into the sky from the rotting trunks and other vegetative matter from deforestation going back a decade or more. And the same thing's happening in the Congo and other places. The authors conclude those lagging stored releases may equal more than a year of direct human emissions. Paul Beckwith, are there other surprise zombie emissions out there?
Well, this is why the climate issue is so serious. This is why, another reason we have to declare a climate change emergency. If you look at the International Energy Agency reports and reports from other people about anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions in the last few years, they argue that we've almost stabilized our anthropogenic, so human-caused emissions. They flattened out, apparently, in 2015, and the rate of rise is much slower than usual in 2014. So with that happening, what's happening to the CO2 level in the atmosphere, the concentration, which is the really important thing? And that the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, about, a couple decades ago, it would rise about one part per million per year. The pre-industrial, it was 280 parts per million. Now it's over 400 parts per million. But the actual rise in 1 year would be, you know, it would be one and a half parts per million for a long time, you know, decades ago. And then in the last decade or two, it's been rising at over 2 parts per million. Well, what happened, you know, in 2015 was that the CO2 concentration rose, I think it was about 3.04 or 3.09 parts per million. It was a record rise in CO2 that particular year. And what's being projected for 2016, something like, I've seen numbers between 4 part per million rise and 5 part per million rise. So why is it so much higher now if we've supposedly stabilized the emissions, you know, or at least lowered the rise in the emissions? And this is the, you could call it the zombie emissions, if you like. I mean, basically, the Earth is warming so much and the physical properties of the surface are changing so much that there's large pools of carbon that are stored on the surface. And we can talk about soil storage. We can talk about storage of carbon in the permafrost frozen that is now thawing and being released. Yeah, we can also talk about sediments in the seafloor. We can talk about, for example, frozen clathrates, which is frozen methane on the seafloor. So there's high pressures and low temperatures, and this stuff is stable. And as you raise the temperature, then the clathrates basically melt, the ice around the methane melts, and the volume greatly expands. And we get things like the Siberian blowholes, or we get things like the spongy ground in the Arctic that people are walking on and is very high in methane and also in CO2. So basically, the greenhouse gases, as we're warming the planet so much and changing the properties, we're unleashing these pools of methane and these pools of, we're thawing out organic matter and it's decomposing, producing methane and CO2, depending on whether there's oxygen available or not. So it is very possible and plausible that we will exceed the limits. So once we decide this is a huge problem and we slash fossil fuel emissions, that alone is not going to solve the problem if we continue to get high emissions of greenhouse gases from the Earth coming out. And this is why we absolutely need to do the other two legs of this three-legged bar stool. We need to cool the Arctic because that's where there's vast stores of carbon that can enter the atmosphere upon heating. And we need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. The levels are just too high. It's causing the ocean acidification, which is threatening the entire marine food chain.
I want to talk for a second about Elon Musk. He's the visionary industrialist behind the Tesla electric car. He's one of the biggest solar panel makers. He's pushing a revolutionary new battery. He runs a private space program used by NASA. Musk is building a gigafactory in Nevada to make the next fossil fuel energy on a massive scale. Even with all that, in a recent interview with MSNBC, Elon Musk is pessimistic about our ability to get out of the carbon trap. He points to all the embedded emissions in our existing power grid and transportation systems, which will take decades to replace, possibly. Musk says it's hard to see how we can slash greenhouse gases in time. Here's a quick sample of that conversation between the billionaire inventor Elon Musk and Chris Hayes of the program called All In on MSNBC.
You talked about, when you released the patent, about how quickly we kind of need to get our act together to forestall real climate problems.
Right.
And it seems to me with the political system the way that it is, that really the only hope is just an incredible explosion innovation. How hopeful are you about that explosion of innovation? What are the obstacles you see, given that you're working at the frontier of battery capacity and all this stuff?
Yeah, I think that the biggest concern I have is the sheer size of the industrial base that is based on gasoline or diesel or sort of fossil fuels. You know, the fact that there's 2 billion vehicles on the roads worldwide, there's 100 million new gasoline cars made a year. Even if all new cars were electric, it would take 20 years to change out the fleet. And of course, we're very far from all new cars being electric. That's what gives me a lot of concern about the future from a climate perspective. We're, you know, quickly exhausting the carbon capacity of the oceans and atmosphere, but we're not quickly moving towards electric cars or
sustainable. It's funny, you sound more pessimistic than I would have imagined you. Like, I would imagine that you're professionally optimistic because you're doing
something. I would say I'm naturally optimistic. But...
Right. I mean, you're doing something that, you know, you'd have to be an optimist to start an electric car company, basically.
Yes.
Or to start a space company or to start a solar company, right? What will it take to basically have the next 10 years of, say, solar and electric renewable energy look like the last 10 years of smartphone development?
I'd love to say that that's even possible. I'd love to say it's possible, but... The thing that's difficult to appreciate, well, I suppose if people think about it for a moment, maybe it's not that hard. It's the sheer size of the economy that depends on hydrocarbons.
Right.
It's truly staggering, to consider. So, I mean, the number of factories that have to be built to produce batteries and electric cars, produce solar panels, it's enormous. It's if you think of all the oil fields and the gas fields and the refineries and you're trying to replace that infrastructure, which is trillions of dollars. So it would be difficult for us to move too fast. But at the same time, I mean, if we said like, okay, let's go as fast as possible, which we're certainly not going, it would still take a long time. That's the thing that I guess makes me a little bit concerned, or maybe more than a little bit concerned about the future, is that the vast amount of infrastructure that has to change.
The legacy stuff that's all just sitting
there.
Yeah,
it's just so big.
I'll toss a link to that YouTube video in my show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. We're doing a full world wrap-up of climate news with Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith. I'm Alex Smith from ecoshock.org. What do you think, Paul? Could corporate visionaries like Elon Musk move out ahead of elected officials and the general population?
If they do it quickly, I guess. If they do it within the next few years before we completely lose sea ice, because... You know, I think we're reaching the point where the public is going to turn from, you know, I'm talking about the general public, I'm not talking about informed people on climate change, where the public is going to say, oh, well, climate change, yeah, it's a problem out in the future, to, my God, you know, we're in serious trouble, we're all going to die, we're finished, there's nothing we can do. You know, the public is going to panic, and that's going to force governments to take strong action, you know, to do the things that I was talking about with the three-legged bar stool. Now, innovators like, you know, Elon Musk, he's a techie, he's an engineer, he's an inventor, you know, he's got many hats, he's also a phenomenal businessman. You know, he started up PayPal, I believe. I haven't read his book, I have his book, I must read it. But he's very concerned about climate change. I mean, the idea of, you know, Tesla creating the, you know, electrifying our transportation grid is all to address climate change. You know, a big part of having electrifying transportation system is to have much better batteries, much higher power density, so much lighter and lighter batteries that contain more and more power, because the power density of gasoline is enormous. So if you can start doing that with batteries, then you can really lower the prices and electrify the transportation system. His whole SpaceX program is because he thinks there's a very grave chance of humans going extinct, and he thinks that we need to populate either the moon or Mars or other planets, because we won't have all our cards on Earth, if you like. I mean, if you will diversify our geographic areas where we live to other planets. And Stephen Hawking is right on board with this. He says we have to actually do these sort of things. So this is a real push on, you know, the technologies. Everything that Elon Musk does is geared to these sort of things. It's geared to, you know, how do we do better on our own planet? And given that things are so bad, can we populate? He's had a very bad week this last week because Solar City, I guess, is it? His solar company had a big hit on the stock market, and some of his Tesla company did, you know, something like $270 million in one day or something, losses on the stock market. And that was the day that the rocket malfunctioned and blew up in California during a test. So that was a very bad day. So next time you're having a bad day, maybe think of, that day for Elon Musk.
I don't think it'll slow him down. I think he'll just keep on going past all that.
I agree. So, I mean, I'd love to get him to somehow, you know, if you have any contacts, if you have any way of getting him, if you know anybody, friend of a friend of a friend who knows Elon Musk, push this idea of this three-legged bar stool. We can't just cut fossil fuel emission usage in our society down to zero. That's only one part of the three things that we must do. But there's no funding for the other two parts of any amount. I mean, there's a little bit, right? I mean, Bill Gates has funded David Keith, the direct carbon removal company, Carbon Engineering or something, and some other companies. But there's a whole public misconception that we're geoengineering the planet already. And so people are against the term geoengineering. So this is a problem because we absolutely do need to remove carbon from the air. We need to cool things with solar radiation management to give us time to do these other two things. It is possible that a couple of people like Elon Musk and Bill Gates, you know, and a few others got together and said, okay, this is what we have to do. We need to put huge amounts of money in removing CO2 from the atmosphere. Then that can make an impact. But I think what's going to happen, you know, how this is playing out is we're going to lose the sea ice. You know, we're going to lose the sea ice in the summer, and it'll be gone for maybe a few weeks to a month, and then the weather, extreme weather events are going to skyrocket up, and then within a few years, we won't have sea ice for, say, 3 months of the year, you know, for August, September, October, be completely clear of ice in the Arctic. So then, you know, within a decade, it's gone year-round. So as these things progress through, the extremes get worse and worse, and they're going to hit us with massive immigration or, you know, much in, like an order of magnitude, 10 or 100 times worse than what we're seeing with the Syrian migration. We're going to have food spikes. We're already starting to see all these things, right? This is why I say this is like it's death by a thousand cuts. I mean, each time we get some massive event happening, like the flooding in Louisiana, so vast parts of Louisiana had several feet of rain in a few days, and we got extensive flooding, and there were, I don't know how many people evacuated, 80,000, 40,000 homes underwater. I mean, this was like Katrina 2.0, really. So these things take a huge impact on the state government. They have to be bailed out by the federal government. And, you know, it takes an enormous economic impact. And then they just rebuild the houses right where they were before. I mean, we're still under that mindset where, you know, they try to rebuild the houses in Louisiana on the same land, you know, same locations where they were before to get flooded out, just until the next flood comes along. So we're seeing the drought in California has reduced the supply of vegetables and caused food prices to be higher. The insurance rates are going up. You know, if you try to insure your house in Canada this year, the rates have jumped. A lot of people's insurance rates have jumped, I don't know, 30%, 20%. And this is because now they've added overland flooding insurance to people's insurance policies, which they never had before. So, you know, when I say death by a thousand cuts, it's all of these different things are occurring which actually attack the resilience of society. They actually chip away at our civilization, at our cities, at our governments, and they cause stress. And as these things pile up one on top of each other, eventually you reach a breaking point. And we're seeing a breaking point in countries already, like in Syria, for example. I mean, it was the massive drought from 2006 to 2010 that displaced about 1.5 million farmers who had their livelihoods farming and now could no longer do it because they couldn't grow anything. There's a massive drought. They moved to the cities, massive unemployment. You know, country basically breaks apart. So this is happening on an ongoing basis. You know, when will it cross a threshold where people actually, you know, wake up and say, we're in serious trouble here? You know, I encourage people, if you're near a university, go in, you know, meet with, you know, phone up or contact the department, find out who the climate people are at the university where you're close to. You know, arrange to just go and chat to them off the record. Say, you know, you're not going to mention any names or something, you're just doing surveys. What do they think really about climate change, right? And you'll get a very different answer to anything that they would say publicly. So that would be an interesting thing for, you know, people. People are always asking, well, what can I do? I mean, what can I do about climate change? And so I'm always trying to think of novel things that I can tell them that may make an impact to get decision makers to finally, you know, declare a climate change emergency and to allow countries to start taking action. Because if we leave it too late, these climate death by a thousand cuts are causing more and more stress on societies. More and more governments will fail. There'll be less and less likelihood that we'll be able to do anything when we're in complete turmoil. You know, I dread to think what will happen in the U.S. if Trump was to somehow win the U.S. presidency. I mean, we're undergoing abrupt climate change. We also seem to be, you know, undergoing an abrupt loss of sanity in society with many of our politicians, many of our leaders, and also the huge misinformation, all these conspiracy theories on the web. These things all reduce our resiliency. They all reduce our ability to be logical and to use science to address the problems and the issues that we're facing. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that cannot be talked about in this, because, like, population is still rising at, you know, an enormous rate. I mean, I always tell people 217,000 net new people per day, but my number is out of date, I was told. It's 243,000 people. So every single morning, there's 243,000 more people on the earth than there were the previous day. You know, this puts tremendous stress. You know, as we're stressing the food systems, as we're stressing that we're reducing biodiversity on our planet, there's huge fresh water issues. You know, as all of these things are happening, leading to geopolitical conflict, meanwhile, we're feeding the pipeline, so to speak, with more and more and more people until, like, we can't ignore these things. These things are happening. If we were a sane society, we would say, okay, we have to level off the total population on our planet and decrease it until we get our ecosystems stabilized. We've got to run this planet as if we really are serious about staying here.
Well, you know, you brought up what people believe that's really off topic. And one subject you and I discussed was the existence or non-existence of a worldwide conspiracy to cool the earth with chemicals delivered by aircraft. People call them chemtrails. A new study published in Environmental Research Letters debunks the chemtrails conspiracy theory. It comes from a large group of the world's top atmospheric chemists. And, you know, I bring that up, Paul, because it's a classic case where millions of people believe things that can be disproven by the facts. We could say the same thing about some religions, but we won't go there. But it's important because in allegedly educated Western countries, polls still find millions of people deny climate change is happening. And stranger still, the denial is often strongest, for example, in American states where they're digging themselves out of massive windstorms, fires, or floods, even as we speak. The human mind is difficult to change when it doesn't want to change.
Yes, absolutely. And if people are paid to believe something, then they believe it even more, right? Yeah, I mean, these conspiracy theories, they're ignored by mainstream science, right? They figure mainstream science has thought, well, you can just ignore it, it'll go away. You know, it doesn't. It gets stronger and stronger, the misinformation, like on the chemtrails. And then, so now they finally come out with this paper, and it's not coincidental that they've just come out with this paper, because scientists around the world are talking a lot more about the need for, say, solar radiation management, the need for carbon dioxide removal. So they don't have any choice now. They have to say, yeah, we have to show that chemtrails are a complete, you know, conspiracy theory, because this is what we actually want to deploy now to address climate change, right? So it's not coincidental that you know, that paper came out. It's also not coincidental that there's a huge author list, because if you have a few people, they would be relentlessly attacked on it. So we need to also do this sort of thing. You know, it's not just chemtrails. That's just one thing. I mean, there's still a misconception out there that, for example, there's this planet X, this Nibiru planet, and it's near the Earth, and astronomers aren't talking about it, and it's changing our weather. It's affecting our weather. It's causing our weirding of the weather. There's this misperception out there that the magnetic fields are changing so quickly that it's causing our weather to be messed up. There's all of these other different things which are being used, and it makes it very easy for fossil fuel companies, for example. You know, if they don't want the real reason about why we have global warming coming out, then they can actually encourage and fund people to have these other crazy views, right? It really takes the focus off greenhouse gases. It clouds the issue. I mean, this is what cigarette companies did to cloud. They clouded the issue of the science on the harmful effects of smoking cigarettes. This is what the fossil fuel companies have done for years. They've clouded the issue. Well, how do you continue to cloud the issue when the science gets stronger and stronger, you know, and is irrefutable on fossil fuels? Well, you talk about the chemtrail. You know, you push these chemtrail things. You push these other things. And, you know, large parts of the public then, I mean, you can't do a climate change article in any forum or any media source and not have, there's comment sections and there's all of these things come up. So, you know, I think it's really important for the science, you know, it's way past the point where the scientific community needs to come and say, look, these are what we think are the craziest, no factual basis conspiracy theories, you know, and go out and really try to educate the public. The scientists are not organized that way to do that. So this is a problem. I mean, we really need to change the way we use scientists and we get information out to the public and all of these things, because we've been failing miserably on this for a long time. As a result, we have people like Trump running for president, and with the, you know, the polling showing the support that he gets. I mean, you know, it's funny. You can talk to people. Okay, you find out a person's a climate denier. Okay, I can almost guarantee you that they probably think chemtrails is happening. They may or may not think there's another planet out there, Planet X. You know, they think vaccines are horrible and kill kids. You know, you don't want to have vaccines anymore. They fall into this box of all of these beliefs.
Yes, that's been proven. I talked to a guest who actually studied climate deniers and found just what you said is what she found. You know, Paul, I used to hope for a people's movement to stop climate change, kind of like the Occupy movement on steroids. But British activist and writer Paul Kingsnorth told us years ago that wasn't going to happen because people would be protesting their own way of life and were so deeply embedded in it. Here, I'll run that quick clip for you.
Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. And so we're complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No Fear Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith, and we're talking about the need for a climate emergency to be called right now. Paul, when you lecture students on climate at the University of Ottawa, you connect with young people who have the most to lose when our future climate runs off the rails. What are they saying?
I think a lot of young people, they know something is terribly wrong. Yeah, they know something is not right with the climate system. I mean, there's very, very few people that are climate change deniers in the young crowd. I mean, the climate change deniers are the old white male type, you know, category of people. The young people are very concerned about what's happening, and they want to learn a lot about what's happening so that they can learn what they could possibly do about it and or what careers they could go into. You know, I'm talking about people that would sort of enroll. I'm not talking about the general population of young people. I'm talking about young people that would be at university and enroll in, say, a course on climate change or a course in environmental issues. You know, a lot of them are pretty committed to trying to learn as much as they can about the problem. And they also feel very, very helpless. I mean, they also feel, you know, very helpless about what they can do. A lot of it is trying to encourage them. It is possible for a small number of people to have a big impact on societal change. I mean, that's, you know, Margaret Mead would have said that that's the only way to do it in a famous quote. You know, a lot of the young people, they don't have all the details of the system. Like, so it's very important, you know, when I teach, I like to try to connect the dots, you know, in most of what I do, connect the dots of what's happening. So I try to give them the skills to sort of critically analyze things. And so there's a lot of different areas touched on. Like, it's very hard to teach just, say, a climate change course and just talk about the science. I mean, you really can't do that. You have to talk about the impact on humans and some psychological impacts. You know, why are there climate deniers? People always, they have this false sense of safety, I think. You know, they think that the Earth is looking after us. Generally, you're safe. You know, there's certain cases where you're not safe, whether it be, tornadoes coming your way or something's happening. But most people, they don't go throughout their day in fear of something happening, right? But more and more often, we're seeing these extreme weather events and things that are affecting a lot of people's lives, or, rising food prices or things. So people are really starting to see some of those things. So I think it's important to teach people how to connect the dots for themselves. That's probably one of the most important things that you can do when you're educating people.
The media isn't going to do it for them. I mean, I see story after story about extreme weather. It's climate porn, really. But they don't mention climate change. They don't talk about the jet stream or any of the things you and I have been talking about in this show.
Yes, so that simply has to change. Like I've mentioned that, I would hope there would be a tipping point in sort of human behavior, human understanding on this problem. And, I've said for quite a while that I think the sea ice could do it. I mean, I'm really looking forward to reading Peter Wadham's new book that just came out September 1st called A Farewell to the Ice. Nobody has more experience in the Arctic and studying sea ice than him. I mean, people may sit in their front of their computer in their office somewhere and do simulations and that. But this is a guy who's been out, in nuclear submarines numerous times. He's been out in the Arctic for the last 40 years, and his book talks about his life studying ice and what's happening now with the ice. And I think he's got a whole chapter on methane. And he's been attacked by many people, scientists and media and so on, because of his views, just saying, sea ice is going a lot quicker than, there's far too many scientists that rely too heavily on models and not enough on what's actually happening on the ground. Models are very important. As the models get better and better, the more you understand how things work and the more data you have to put into your models, but they're not going to be modeling something you don't understand or you don't even know about. And we're getting all of these surprises in the climate system.
Yeah, so that's Peter Wadhams, W-A-D-H-A-M-S, A Farewell to Ice. I'll put a link to that on my EcoShock blog for sure. Well, as we wrap up, I wish there was a big picture of what's actually going on. And you've given us a lot in this show, I must say. But it's so hard to do for human affairs, Paul, because we humans hide so much, for one thing, and we lie to ourselves. And then there's billions of relatively intelligent beings constantly changing the rules and roles of the game. But for climate science, can we try to pinpoint where we are on the curve of climate disruption? Where are we, Paul?
Well, where we are on the curve of climate disruption, think of a line sloping upward slightly, not a lot. And then the line suddenly ends, okay? And then break that line, say, at a certain point, and then take the right-hand part of that line and then just lift it up to the top of the page and then connect the leftmost part. And you get a very steep line joining the two. So you have a stable state, which is where we were, and you have a stable state, which is where we're heading to. And right now we're in that rapidly moving upward line. So how far along that line are we? Well, we're not that far along that line. I mean, we're seeing lots of disruption, but in the past we've seen the temperature jump on the planet, at least in the, Greenland region, 5 degrees Celsius in a decade or two. In the Paleo-Eocene thermal maximum, we've seen a 5 degree rise in 13 years. So we can have that type of rise in a decade. So we're nowhere near that right now. So I would say we're on that steeply rising line, but we've just passed into it. So in the past, without humans on the planet, then we would just continue to rocket up to this new state and have, you'd have massive changes without humans. But right now, we've just pushed into this rapidly rising line. So if we can get our act together and recognize this is what we've done, then by slashing fossil fuel emissions before the emissions from the Earth swamp us out, by cooling the Arctic to keep the fossil fuel emissions from swamping us out, all of the organic material up there that can thaw and produce these emissions, and remove the CO2 from the atmosphere as quickly as possible, all of these things at the same time, then we have a chance to bring us back from that steep part of the line to the stable line again. you know, can we do it? I don't know. But do we need to try? Absolutely. We have to try. You know, we can't just roll over and give up on this climate change issue. But we, in order to try, we have to collectively try. We have to row in the same direction as a species to do this. So how is this ever going to happen? Well, we're starting to see, I would argue that there has been massive changes in how people have been talking about climate change in the last few years, in government action. I mean, just a few day or two ago, China and the U.S. signed on to the agreement that was decided in Paris. Other countries will come along soon. Scientists are talking about the necessity of removing. So before it was all like one of the Barstool slash emissions, that was it, that was sufficient. James Hansen is still saying that that's all we need to do. If we slash emissions quickly, the Earth can pull out the CO2. So he doesn't even say we need to do anything else. But a lot of scientists, I follow a lot of emails, I talk to a lot of people, a lot of scientists are starting to say we need to do carbon dioxide removal and take CO2 out of the atmosphere. That's becoming vital, and we need huge amounts of funding to do that, looking at all the methods, whether it be biochar, whether it be fertilization of the oceans, whether it be direct air capture, companies, startups, whatever. You know, even putting more in the soils and having less deforestation, more afforestation, all of these things are for removing CO2 out of the atmosphere. So they're all talking about that leg, but there's very few of them in public that are talking about the solar radiation management leg. But I've heard rumblings that in the U.S. government, I mean, they have to be. They have to be looking at can we put sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere and cause a rapid cooling. You know, they're looking at these things, but a lot of these things aren't so publicly out there. And again, the air is smoky because of all the conspiracy theories on chemtrails and geoengineering. So I think that's where we are. I think we pushed over into this area of abrupt change. But, you know, we can continue to deny, argue, do stupid things and go up there worse. Like fracking took us further along that line for sure. I mean, fracking was... It was driven by corporations to make money. And what did it do? Sure, you replace some coal, but the leakage rate from the fracking operations puts more methane in the atmosphere, and which completely negates the advantage of using natural gas over coal.
And with cheaper gas and oil, people use more of it. That's Jevons' paradox. So
exactly.
It didn't really solve anything. But, you know, I like the fact that you say, it's hopeless, but we have to try. And that's sort of why I do this program. As we finish, Paul, would you tell our listeners where they can find your work and how they can keep up with it?
Yeah. I'm not saying that it's hopeless. I think presently, with the way we're doing things, it's hopeless. Like, until we recognize, but we need to recognize that our existing pathway, things we do, are putting us in a hopeless situation. And do things differently. And then, so I'm not saying that the whole, you know, I still have hope that there's things that we can do to turn this bus around. I'm not personally thinking that the situation is hopeless. And in terms of finding my stuff, well, first of all, there's my website. It's paulbeckwith.net. That's paulbeckwith.net. So my website, I've got lots of stuff on there. And also my YouTube channel. I do lots of YouTube videos. And if you just Google YouTube, Paul Beckwith, you can find my YouTube videos and follow me there. And if you just Google my name and climate change, you can find loads of stuff. And then if you just sort it by, you know, date, then you can get the recent stuff. That's another very easy way to find things.
I also like your Facebook page, which is kind of like a climate news feed. And I'm going to put links to that and the stories we've been talking about in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. So listeners, you can check that. It's published every Wednesday. Paul, thank you again for helping us kick off a new season of Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm your host, Alex Smith. In the new carbon-charged world, you are listening to Radio EcoShock, broadcast around the world on radio, satellite, and the Internet. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, at archive.org, and our website, ecoshock.org. Tune in. Turn off.